thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 103, recorded Thursday, February 27th. Big data to big business.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Digital Campus. This is episode 103. I have to apologize that it's been so long since you've had a Digital Campus episode in your feed. We did record something a couple weeks ago, but I forgot to actually press record, so we didn't record it at all. We just had a nice conversation, and you know, as everyone knows, that's a huge waste of time. So at any rate, we're going to have another nice conversation today, and we are in fact recording, so we might as well get to it. I'm joined by the usual regular podcast hosts. We have Stephen Robertson, director of the Center for History and New Media. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Amanda.
We have Tom Scheinfeld, who has a title that's about a paragraph long at the University of Connecticut. Hello, Tom.
Yeah, University of Connecticut's fine. Hi, thanks.
Hi. We have Dan Cohen, executive director of the Digital Public Library of America. Hello, Dan.
Hello, a.k.a. Internet Czar.
Internet czar. Putin of the internet. I think Putin is the Putin of the internet. And we have Mills Kelly, who is a professor of history here at George Mason University. Hello, Mills.
Hello, Amanda.
And we have several stories for you this week. The first one, we have a sort of a set of stories that are about opening access to various kinds of publications and data. One of the first ones is that the Getty, sort of a very well-known museum out there on the West Coast, has created a new virtual library that is offering over 250 art books for free download. One of the others is that Twitter is offering a grant program for researchers to work with its data set. So Twitter is introducing data grants. And then the third story is that Microsoft Research is really putting quite a bit of weight behind committing to the open science movement. I might add, actually, this is sort of last minute, but I've actually been following a story for the last week or so, and I'll see if I can find a link for the other podcast hosts. PLOS, the Public Library of Science, has just created a data policy that's causing a bit of controversy, where they're requiring scientists who publish in PLOS to say in their article where other researchers can get the data that is in that article. So I'll find a link to that. So let me ask, just in general, Dan, you're executive director of a project that is very committed to sharing data openly on the web. Do you think that this new sort of spate of open data and open publication initiatives is signaling that that's where the internet is going?
Yeah, you know, I would add a couple things here. I mean, speaking of open data and back to the Getty, by the way, these art books are really cool, and I encourage our readers to check it out. We'll have the link in the show notes. The Getty also released recently their vocabulary for art and architecture, which is used by a lot of museums, and they released it as a
linked
open data service that allows others to sort of standardize around it. I think this is a very commonly used vocabulary, so essentially set of standardized descriptive metadata. And You know, now they're sort of making it more openly available. It's still under a attribution license, but I have some issues about trying to maintain attribution for things like open data across multiple services where things are getting commingled. We could talk about that later. But, you know, I think that there are, seeing all of this this cluster of opening of data is encouraging. I think all of them have, I think, bits of strings and problems attached that we can talk about. But, you know, I don't think any of this is controversial. In fact, I'm curious as to why forcing scientists to link to their data is controversial at all. It seems like good standard practice.
Seems like, yeah, good science.
Well, no, that's exactly the thing, you know, is that most of the objections that I've read have to do with the logistics, that
basically,
a pain to do it. And, you know, the other side of the argument, which, of course, is the side I'm on, is that, like, it doesn't matter if it's a pain. It's good science. But, like, some people are actually joking because they literally have, you know, terabytes and terabytes of data. And, you know, they're just worried about how to make that available at all, other than on hard drives. But, again, my attitude is, like, I don't care how hard it is to put it in some kind of reasonably open repository, even if it's on hard drives in a library, and you tell people you have to come to this library in order to access the hard drives. That's way better than, you know, sticking those hard drives in your office and then having Hurricane Katrina happen and getting them flooded out.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's like sort of a red herring to point to, like, you know, the few high energy particle physicists or the Hubble astronomers who have these, you know, huge data sets. I mean, the vast majority of scientists, it seems to me, have kind of manageable data sets that they could, you know, most of the articles that are being published are backed by, you know, studies of, you know, medical studies and things are backed by, you know, maybe large-ish, but not kind of extra internet size data sets. So it seems to me that it's like, well, okay, fine. There are probably some edge cases where it's difficult or impossible to do, but that pulls the argument in a direction that I don't think it needs to go in.
Well, and they've allowed for that in the policy, I feel. They say, you know, on a case-by-case basis, we'll, you know, consider exceptions. But and, you know, the thing about PLOS that's really great is that they accept everything, you know, and they peer review everything very carefully. But it's all, you know, some people are saying, well, this will discourage me from publishing in PLOS journals. And, you know, I'm like, then fine, don't publish in the PLOS journals if, you know, making your data available is such a big deal.
Yeah, don't make your writing public in that way.
Right.
Well, I think overall what this trend is showing is that a lot of different kinds of institutions, and these are very different kinds of institutions, I mean, Microsoft, Twitter, the Getty, very different kinds of institutions, I think they're all seeing examples where unexpected uses and creative uses of open data have really actually helped people do new things. And so they're seeing the value of that. And I think they're also starting to see, and this is a lot of what I do as an advocate for open access at DPLA, is that it doesn't detract any at all from what they're doing. It doesn't subtract value from their collection. In fact, it adds to it. I think the Getty putting out this vocabulary means more places will use the vocabulary. Yes, they may forego, I guess, some vocabulary licensing fees potentially for some services, but I just think it strengthens their hand in many ways. And so I think that's what we're starting to see. And that wasn't the case, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, where, you know, I think any economist would tell them that scarcity is the best way to go.
I think that, you know, the Getty story is a big one in that I feel it's symbolic for a lot of, especially art museums, but just the museum world in general. I mean, the Getty was sort of famously proprietary, you know, in licensing the vocabularies and its other materials. And for them to make a kind of about face like this, I think sends a pretty strong signal to the rest of the museum community that this is maybe the way to go. I mean, so I think symbolically it's a big deal. I mean, I think, you know, practically and substantively it's a big deal too, but symbolically it's maybe even a bigger deal.
So Tom, I actually wanted to get your take specifically on the Twitter data grants story. As I know from when I was working with you, you are a grant-getting machine. Is this grant program something that you're interested in, and what are your thoughts on it generally?
I'm interested in that. I'm pleased that Twitter is granting this access to their data. The problem with these grants, it's granting you use of the data. It's not providing any means, financial means, to actually do anything with it. It's giving you access to the services that companies would normally have to pay for. So it's a kind of grant in kind from Twitter. So I think, you know, if you already have the time and the means and the staff and the capability to do something with that data, that's great. But I wouldn't want to give the impression to like the digital humanities community that there's like money dangling out there from Twitter, because there's not.
Oh, do you know, I missed that bit. I saw the word
grant.
Right,
it's not money. So, I mean, it could be, I mean, a great thing, for instance, for if you had a student project. And I'm teaching a course this semester, graduate seminar this semester, which is operating a little bit like our One Week, One Tool Summer Institute, where we're building a thing in a sort of fixed, constrained amount of time. And we contemplated talking to Twitter about getting access to this data stream to do something with it. We ultimately decided to go in another direction, which we'll talk about, which the podcast listeners will learn about at the end of the semester. But so I think for something like that, it could be really, really great. But it's not a funding program.
And look, and I do think that you know, Amanda's sort of spin slide over that, I think, is actually important. I mean, they're granting the data, and for those of us who are in the business of getting grants in order to work with data, you know, a model where, you know, the grant is simply the data and no ability to work with it has, you know, I have to say, does disturb me a little bit. You know, if you're in a position to use the data, yes, but you know, it's not really opening up the data in quite the way, I guess, that we would have hoped for. I mean, it's not, in some ways, you know, for Twitter, it's easy to understand why they, you know, they see it as a grant. But I think, you know, the reality is that the vast majority of the people who would want to use this would need more than just the data. And you know, as a model for, you know, for opening up the data, you know, I don't know that I'd want to see too many more people thinking that the data alone is really going to unleash people upon the material.
So do we think that this is any kind of a slap in the face to the Library of Congress, who does have a Twitter archive that so far is not open to researchers?
Well, I think there's been some, you know, obviously unexpected complexities around that. You know, I think what Twitter's providing is somewhat different than, let's say, the historical archive. I think they're going to make this data in a kind of high availability and computationally, you know, manipulable fashion. So I don't think that they're just, you know, letting people come in and take a billion tweets and go home with it. So unless I'm misunderstanding that. So, you know, I think the LC's thing, whenever it gets up and running, I think will be a great place to kind of like go back and go through the archive and find historically important tweets or do some pattern analysis. But I think what Twitter's really interested in is like computational science on their stuff. And it's probably, you know, even I think a little bit slightly self-serving in that they have clearly come up with some potential new business models out of letting people do those kinds of explorations. Like they had a recent announcement about this music program where they're providing, and clearly in the long run for a fee, access to music data, what people are saying about albums and musicians and things like that, to record labels so that they get intelligence on those sorts of things. So I think, you know, obviously some of it will be digital humanities-esque sorts of stuff, but there'll also be people coming in wanting to do econometrics and all kinds of things on it that probably will impact their business.
Yeah, see, that was my take on it. I had a much more cynical take on the whole thing, which is that they're still trying to figure out how to monetize all that data successfully. And so by giving people access to the data, I think they're hoping that there will be some inspiration that comes out of that. You know, people do various studies, and other people who work with big data will say, oh, yeah, maybe we could use that Twitter data for finding out something for our business. So I don't see it as like a boon to academia. I see it as a boon to Twitter's business model, which is, after all, what they're in business to do.
Interesting take. I actually, I went to the Microsoft Faculty Summit, not last summer, but the summer before, so already like a year and a half ago, and heard a few presentations there about people who were doing computational research with Twitter. And somebody in particular, I think it might have been, I'm not sure who, but somebody said, you know, Twitter for certain kinds of social science and certain kinds of computer science problems is a little bit like the fruit fly in biology. It's something that everyone can access at least a little bit of, although not at the rate that Twitter's now offering, and that therefore that's the data that everybody uses. You know, it would be great to do research on Facebook data, but that's much harder to get because it's not really on the open web. So they're saying that there's a danger in a way of the Twitter data set skewing the results of the kinds of analysis that are being done. Well, thanks for those perspectives. Always happy to see lots of open access initiatives and open data initiatives going on. We'll move to something completely different now, which is a story that's maybe a little bit old now, except it still is just so Jetsons to me. Our friend of the podcast, Brian Alexander, attended the recent EduCause as a doppelbot. He basically sent an iPad on a wheeled stick, if I'm not mistaken. So would any of you like to try this out at any conference that you're booked to go to in the coming months?
I've pre-ordered 3 of these, Amanda. I call them Dan 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
And that's how I'm going to attend all of my various meetings in 2014.
I see the Doppelbot as just revolutionizing the faculty meeting. notice the nervous chuckles around the but just imagine that the department chair and a whole bunch of bots. Just think about how much would get done. It would be awesome.
I can't imagine that it would be. I really do not go to faculty meetings. You know, I don't know whether I can, but I can't imagine anything sort of getting done. I think this is just hilarious and adorable, but if I were to take it really, really seriously, I think it's a bad idea. You know, I mean, my whole position for the last 4 years has been about bringing people together face to face, and these are, you know, it's people who are online with one another basically all day, every day, and there's still such a value to getting people together face to face that you know, if I were going to be really I don't know, if I were going to give a Jeremiah ad about this, I could. Terrible idea. Telepresence isn't real presence. You know.
She says over Skype.
She says over Skype. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the whole point of a conference is that you do travel there, right? And I feel like we can just get so much more information with all of our 5 or arguably 6 senses. That's more valuable to do it that way, but.
Well, so I'm going to, I mean, you know, the bot thing is, you know, it was a certain amount of a stunt, but and kind of a cool stunt, you know, it was fun to watch. But, you know, I have a colleague who has 4 children under the age of 12, and he believes that, you know, family dinner is really important in his family, and he travels a lot and for work, and and it seems a little strange to me, but they set up an iPad on the dinner table, and so when he's traveling, wherever he is, he Skypes into family dinner, and I wonder, like, this is the Jetsons part, Amanda, you know, so his kids are growing up sometimes seeing dad, sometimes dad is just a little rectangle there at the head of the table. And it is a little odd, but maybe not so odd to the kids.
I mean, and that's true for increasing numbers of people whose families are spread out around the world. That, you know, I know my 6-year-old niece overwhelmingly through Skype. You know, and as you know, deteriorated as that might be from what Amanda's imagining, and it's an advantage over trying to talk to, you know, young babies on telephones and things, which was the alternative. So, I mean, this is, you know, maybe one step too far if you imagine the alternative as actually being there. But I guess if it has any real future, it's for the people who in some ways or another couldn't be there, not as an alternative to face-to-face, but as, you know, a way to include in some way people in the conversation more. But I mean, the only other place that I saw this was there was a Good Wife episode where they had a telecommuting staff member trying to do this, and certainly in their version of it, it becomes, you know, the presence becomes, you know, not very real at all, because it's too easy to, you know, ignore the iPad on the stick or drive it in.
Slam the door.
Yeah, exactly. You know, trip it up and all of those kinds of things. And so it becomes, you know, maybe that is the faculty, you know, meeting model, where basically you can just, you know, sabotage all of the virtual people. But so, you know, I think there are limits to it. But yeah, if it's got a future, it's to bring people into the conversation who can't be there in some other kind of way. And maybe it will make sense to a generation of children who grow up, you know, interacting with large numbers of people through Skype on some type of device or another.
Well, but I guess my my beef with it a little bit is, it's one thing to bring somebody in remotely who can't be there. And I'm, you know, relatively used to that happening at conferences now. People will Skype in, you know, and they're on a screen. Maybe you make some jokes about the big head on the enormous projection screen and whatever. But what's interesting about doing this specifically as a telepresence robot is that it does seem to be trying to mimic physical presence with a sort of a body and a head in a way that just, you know, bringing somebody in on the phone or as a disembodied voice or as a disembodied head doesn't do, right? So it's like Freud's uncanny, you know, uncanny valley. It's like, here's a thing that is sort of trying to mimic
being a person. Digital humanity cyborg.
Yeah,
I just don't know how much value the stick adds, right? Like,
he can move.
That's right. He's moving around, interacting with
like,
people.
But like, he's on the screen only.
But the panel is sitting down at the table, and the audience is sitting down in the chairs, and it's like. If it was to play basketball or something, I could see the usefulness.
So speaking of an iPad on a segue, let's segue into the Pew Report released on the anniversary of the web. So I believe today is the anniversary of the World Wide Web, of its... I haven't looked at it, what exactly it's an anniversary of, but something to do with...
I think it's March 12th, 1989 that Tim Berners-Lee published the paper.
Oh, so they're ramping up to the March
12th.
They're
ramping up, yes. Got it. So we're recording on, what is it, the 27th of February today, so it's in a couple of weeks coming up.
So it's not the date that he sent out an email to somebody somewhere saying, hey, can you hear me? or come here, I need you.
It's when his head on a stick came through the door.
Mills, I think, you know, you're making jokes that only historians are going to get now. But that's all right. Have people looked at this Pew report, their summary of findings about the sort of impact of the web at 25?
I took a quick look this morning, and I think what really jumps out is, I think, especially since a bunch of us have been sort of griping about how annoying parts of the internet have become recently, or seem to have become, like on Twitter, I think there's a sentiment that it's like gotten a little sour among certain parties. But, you know, if you look at the overall report, it's just really, really sunny about how much people love the internet and, the most, I think, interesting stat is that it is the sort of media that people would be least willing to give up. 46% of the people they surveyed said that they would, it would be the one thing they could not give up. It's, in fact, a higher percent than TV and other things. You know, I think there's just a lot of love for what Tim Berners-Lee did, and you know, people clearly find a lot of value in it, and you know, the adoption rates and all that stuff you can see in their charts that we'll link to in the show notes are just you know, really through the roof. That there's still you know, I think 10% of people who are not online, but essentially there's been a pretty full adoption, especially compared to other technologies.
But also, I thought it showed how soft the commitment to social media is compared to some of the others. You know, one of the questions was, "What's the thing you can't live without?" And the largest percentage of the respondents would give up their social media over, for instance, their landline.
Right. That was interesting that they broke that out from the internet in general. And email as well.
I had two kind of problems with, and I haven't taken a close enough look at it, but I have two kind of related problems with the data, and it's partly an artifact of the kind of historical study that they've done where they've asked the same questions over time, and but one is that it doesn't make a distinction, I don't think, between the internet and the web. Which are two very different things, right? While people may be as addicted and enamored of the internet as they always were, the web, which is, you know, ostensibly what they're celebrating here, I think people have a kind of more ambiguous relationship with, or maybe less a close relationship, where people, a lot of their internet use has migrated to things like proprietary applications and things. So that's one thing. And then related to that is that the internet for most people, so they say, well, the internet's more important than television, but that's because that's where I watch most of my video now. right? That I spend most of my TV watching on Netflix or on Amazon Instant Video. And so separating out what is TV from what is internet, or separating out what is social media from what is internet, or what is, you know, we were just talking about Skype and how important that's become as telecommunications. Separating out what is the phone from what is the internet, or what is the mobile device from what is the internet. Those distinctions almost are meaningless now. It's all the internet for a lot of people. So I wonder if you know, I don't know what to do about this, whether it's to change the questions or change the categories or educate people better about how they're actually receiving various data streams. But there's some fuzziness there that I think is easy to gloss over.
And I think there's also some value in reading those numbers a little bit against the grain of the enthusiasm. Like the adoption numbers still kind of disturb me. And you know, when they break them down by education and by economic group, there is, you know, the numbers of people outside this internet world are still higher than I think we're, you know, as a commonplace we think of. You know, we're talking about something like a quarter of the people, you know, without high quality educations, who are not part of this world in a way that, you know, in a world of political rhetoric about inequality, there's plenty in this report, I think, on the other side of these numbers to point to some significant inequalities that still exist in the United States around this, in a way that, you know, we're not used to talking about in quite the same kind of way. And, you know, I think that for all of the rise in those numbers, you know, there's other numbers on the other side of the equation that I think bear a bit of thinking about as well.
You know, I read a post on the internet the other day, amazingly enough, which argued very strongly that the internet is a utility. It was like water and electricity, and it was sort of in reaction to a whole bunch of threats to net neutrality. And I have to say that as much as I depend on the internet, I do not think that the internet is a utility. And in fact, you know, it used to be that landline service was regulated as a utility, and they deregulated that. And, you know, landline service kind of basically isn't exactly a utility anymore, certainly not in the way that water and electricity are. So, I mean, I'd have to agree. I was particularly annoyed in this today's report by, you know, what you were pointing out, Tom, the sort of collapsing of the distinction between the internet and the web. And yeah, I too, you know, get a lot of my TV over the internet, so it seems like a weird distinction to separate out TV from the internet exclusively. I watched Tina Fey and Amy Poehler's intro to the Golden Globes on YouTube because I don't have a television, and I particularly loved their joke when they were talking about the original television programming that Netflix was doing, which, you know, one of their show, I think House of Cards or something, was up for an award. And they said, you're going to be, you won't be laughing so hard in 5 years when Snapchat is up for best drama, which I thought was hilarious and like not unlikely in a weird way, you know, that like the internet actually is an entertainment medium, in many ways really similar to television movies.
Which then raises the question of, I don't get, it's good that I don't run big companies because I don't get this. How do you pay that many billions of dollars for WhatsApp when Facebook's market share is eroding in the youth market? And a recent study from, I think it was the University of Michigan, said that 77% of college students are using Snapchat every single day, and high school students is probably about 112%. And so $19 billion for a messaging service that they say they don't even want to make money on. Clearly, Facebook is printing money these days.
Absolutely. I'm glad you segued to that story, Mills. What are other people? I mean, my reaction to this is, A, what's WhatsApp? And B, weren't we all just 2 years ago outraged about $1 billion for Instagram? I mean, what is this logarithmic explosion? That's my only take on it. Anybody else have anything more sophisticated?
Just there to make the Instagram folks feel terrible about selling for $1 billion. I don't know. It's no, I think, you know, I, of course, like had barely heard of it as well. You know, I think it's part of this move off of the web that we're used to and onto kind of private channels that's happening. I think we've discussed on this podcast, many podcasts on Digital Campus about how, you know, Facebook would have this sort of problem where once mom and grandma are there, that the kids want to kind of go elsewhere. And so I think there's a piece of this that along with Snapchat is sort of moving the chatter into private channels and off of the public web and the places that those of us on this podcast tend to hang out, places like Twitter or blogs or things that are open on the open web, into these sort of private realms. I think that's one piece of it. And the piece I learned that I had no idea about after this broke was also that I think a key part of this is that WhatsApp works on kind of everything. And we're so used to, and this gets to I think Stephen's point too about the still existing digital divide. You know, WhatsApp went through the complete hell of programming for almost every kind of phone, including, I think, very critically for Facebook's valuation of them, the phones that are generally used outside of first world nations. So cheap phones with, they're still running like, you know, WAP and all these old protocols and have tiny screens and have weird little SMS-ish kinds of interfaces. You know, they solved all that so you can pretty much chat with anyone globally. I think that was the key part of it for them.
Yeah, I think this is a story about how much is going on outside the United States. You know, I also heard another take by the folks who run the Accidental Tech podcast. I don't know if people are familiar with that show. It's a pretty good show. But one of the things they were saying is that it is also a little disturbing that while, you know, WhatsApp is cross-platform and it runs on everything, it's still like a walled garden. I mean, we're still kind of moving from one proprietary messaging system to another. You know, we were first, you know, first we were all on ICQ, then we're all on AIM, then we're all on GChat. Now everybody's going to, you know, to WhatsApp or whatever. And it just seems couldn't there be some kind of email like system where like it's not owned by one company, where we, you know, do this thing, which is this messaging thing, but we do it, you know, via an open protocol. So, I mean, going back to our first story about open data and openness, you know, it's just disturbing that every couple of years I have to change my messaging client to some new thing that is the next app and does exactly the same thing that the ICQ client did in 1998. So I don't know. That's the sort of another perspective on this, but it's something that just drives me a little nuts.
Well, I would use that, Tom.
That electronic mail idea just like blew my mind.
Yeah,
I just wrote that down on the pad here in my office. Electronic mail. We could even shorten it to email. That's just awesome.
Does it have a hyphen or does it not have a hyphen, Dan?
Not sure yet. Not sure.
All right. We'll work on that.
No, okay.
Capital E.
To be more serious, I mean, I think that's what, you know, the promise of this web is, right? Is that there, it's just creates the ability for interchange, right? And
I think it is
crazy that we're now like roping these things back off and sending them into different channels. And
well, it isn't crazy in a way, because even though we did have the whole conversation about the benefits of openness, and that's certainly a trumpet I think that we've all been tooting for the last few years, we're really in a phase where people are especially with all the Snowden and NSA stuff, where people are really beginning to appreciate the benefits of privacy as well. So I think in a way Tom is right on it when he says that we need something with an open protocol, but that has private messaging, you know. And there, I mean, it's not as though there aren't those things. I mean, there are, open source chat apps and ICQ and things like that. But it's just, it's weird. It doesn't have the universal adoption that email does. But I think a lot of people used to think of the, the public web as, even things like LiveJournal, as places that were more private than they actually were. And people are beginning to realize, I think, that they're not as private as they thought. All right. Well, thank you all for that. Interesting take. Lots of stuff to keep an eye on, especially regarding privacy and openness. We just want to end with a report from the center. We have with us Dr. Sharon Leon, who is the Director of Public Projects here at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media. Hello, Sharon.
Hello, Amanda. So I am here today to give the very brief report from the center. And as we approach the end of February and beginning of March, we wanted to remind our listening audience that the center is offering two summer institutes this summer, one funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Office of Digital Humanities, and one funded by the Getty Foundation. And our goal in these two summer institutes is to attract mid-career scholars, in one case, American historians, and in another case, art historians, mid-career scholars who don't have a lot of technical skills, but who would like to begin the journey into digital humanities. So if you find yourself a frequent listener to Digital Campus, but not someone who feels like they have a lot of digital skills to go forward with digital work, you may consider applying for one of these two-week summer institutes. The applications are open now, and they are open until March 15th. And both of the applications and sites can be accessed from doingdh.org. The Institute for Art Historians is in July, and the Institute for American Historians is in August. So I hope you'll take a look at the site and a look at the agenda for the 2 weeks for both of those institutes and consider making an application.
Very nice. Thank you, Sharon.
You're
Sounds
welcome.
Great. There was a lot of, I went to that Camp CAA, the College Art Association, a few weeks ago, and there was just so much interest there, particularly in just getting into digital art history. It's been going on a little bit at the fringes, and there's a sense that the profession in general hasn't maybe kept up with what historians in general, digital historians in general, are doing. And so there's a lot of interest and a lot of excitement.
Well, that is, in fact, our hope for these, is that we know that there are a lot of people who are out there who are interested, who just haven't found the right venue to begin learning the skills to do more of this work. You know, it's often, in some cases, easier for graduate students to find this stuff around the edges, but folks who are sort of a little bit further down the line in their careers and have a lot of responsibilities may not have taken the time out to teach themselves these kinds of things. So we're going to try and help everyone skill up over the summer.
Yeah, that's great. And I actually, I'm a big believer in that you don't have to learn everything, but you sort of need to learn what you don't know so that you can maybe find the people who have the skills you need to do some very large project. So
yeah, and that's a major hope of this, is that we can spend enough time with the participants so that they learn how to learn these kinds of skills.
Exactly. All right, well, thank you very much to everyone for joining me. It is exactly noon, so I send you all off to have, I hope, a delicious lunch. And farewell for now to our podcast audience. We'll see you next time on Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.